everyone, and welcome to another edition of NatCon Australia. Today, I'm delighted to welcome Simon Hankinson, who is a Senior Research Fellow at the Border Security and Immigration Centre at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C. From 1999 to 2022, he was a Foreign Service Officer serving in India, Fiji, Ghana, Slovakia, Togo, Washington, D.C., Marseille, and Nairobi. Prior to entering the State Department, he worked as a lawyer in London and then taught history, English, and drama at a private school in Miami. Hankinson holds a master's degree in modern history from St. Andrews, Scotland, a degree from the College of Law in London, and a master's degree in international security affairs from the National Defense University in Washington. Welcome, Simon.
Thanks for having me.
In February 2018, there was a get-together of various leading think tanks in Washington. And at that meeting, Rene Reno, the editor of First Things magazine, remarked that it is really quite telling that places like AEI and Heritage don't have full-time staff working on immigration questions, when in fact it turns out to be the single most salient political issue in the West in the 21st century. Clearly that has changed because you are now working at Heritage. How much of a focus is immigration now amongst the big think tanks in Washington, D.C.?
Well, at Heritage, it's certainly become a much bigger focus. I was working at the State Department until 2022 when I retired, perhaps a little earlier than I had contemplated, to come to work at Heritage because I had learned that Laura Reese was setting up, who'd been working on immigration issues at Heritage, but also other things, Homeland Security, was setting up a new Border Security and Immigration Center. And they were looking for somebody with my experience or something similar. And then since then, we've added visiting fellows who used to run the three biggest immigration-related parts of Homeland Security, and a couple other permanent staff, because I think the people running Heritage could see that this was becoming more and more of an issue. We really hadn't had major legislation or major reform. And when I say reform, for conservatives, that means get it under control, maybe limit immigration, make it in the national interest. And for the left, it means, you know, open the borders. But leaving that aside for a minute, politically, nothing had changed since about 1996. And in 2020, we saw, well, 2021, when President Biden took over, we saw this incredible experiment of open borders, just sort of undoing everything that had kept the border controlled and had limited the number of people that came in and where they came in and done some kind of security vetting and so on. So this has been a major focus for the Heritage Foundation, and I think other think tanks have probably put some more people behind it. And we saw that in this election in November, it was the top issue for Republican voters, and it was one of the top five, at least for all voters. So it's become a huge national issue, I think, for countries in Europe, for the whole West. It's become a much more salient issue than it was maybe 20 years ago.
Mm. I mean, legal immigration in the US is in a far worse state than Australia. Can you give, for an Australian audience's benefit, just a sense of it? Because we had a major political issue, as you might be aware, in stopping boats coming across the East Timor Sea, and we implemented something called offshore processing and special classes of visas for that. But that was, you know, at its worst, 1,000 people a year that we had to deal with, or more or less, you know, in the thousands at the very most. You guys deal with something on a completely different scale.
Yes, and I've looked into the Australian model. I think it really is the best bipartisan model of how to stop, you know, mass illegal immigration. Now, it does help that you're an island. You have a ways to, and the nearest sort of third world country is quite a way away, whereas the United States directly borders with Mexico, which is a developing country, at least, or has a lower standard of living than the U.S., which in turn borders with, you know, Central American countries and kind of right down the continent. So geographically, we're in a different position. But yeah, in terms of scale, we've always had illegal immigration. We've always had encounters, they call them. It's really arrests, people being stopped at the border, coming in illegally by the Border Patrol, or what they call gotaways, entry without inspection, EWI, people who just sneak in. And these days we can probably spot at least half of those because we have cameras and sensors and other ways to know that someone came in if we can't identify them. But the number of encounters under the Biden administration has gone from, you know, I think under the previous administration, or rather under the Obama administration, the Secretary of Homeland Security, Jay Johnson, said that if we had 1,000 illegal aliens encountered at the border, that was a bad day. And I think he said, you know, 2,000 would be a disaster or something. Well, we had 10,000 a day was a normal day for much of this administration. I think the worst month in U.S. history for illegal alien encounters was December of last year. So a year ago this month, it was somewhere in the order of 350,000 illegal immigrants, people trying to get into the country illegally, encountered at the border, or, and this is something maybe we can get into later, let in under one of these bogus parole programs, because there's still people entering the country illegally. They're just being given a fig leaf of legality by the administration. So yeah, 300,000 people a month. And if you add that up, that's the highest, but the average was still well over 150,000 a month. It's gotten a little lower in the past few months for basically political reasons. But we're talking millions of people, at least 2 million people, we estimate, were gotaways who entered without inspection that we have absolutely no idea about. Maybe 1.5 million were paroled in, meaning that they have a status that is sort of parallel to, it's not a real legal status, and it could be revoked at any point. And then in terms of how many were released at the border into, you know, theoretical asylum proceedings, it could be, you know, anywhere from 5 to 10 million. So yeah, this is an extraordinary.
The language is always different across jurisdictions, and you have things in the US which we don't have. For example, sanctuary cities is not a term you encounter in Australia, because, well, I think the main reason for it is that in Australia we have a federation, but the states are responsible for the police force in each state, not the cities. So the cities can't establish a sanctuary city. And this parole business, it sounds a little bit like some type of temporary protection visa or words to that effect, but or maybe it's a particular US thing. I'm trying to think of the exact analogy for it. But in any event, it's a way that people can be waived in on a temporary basis and then live in Springfield, Ohio, and other places, right? And then use that as a basis for establishing permanent residency. Is that how it kind of works?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely worth talking about, because parole was built into the 1952, I think it is, Immigration and Nationality Act. And it was, you know, it's a different time when it was assumed that the executive would be responsible and reasonable in the way that it used its powers. And so they built in this sort of exceptional ability to bring someone in. They're not technically admitted. It's not a visa. They have no permanent status, no really status at all. It's sort of, it goes outside the legal immigration system. For example, if somebody wasn't able to get a visa for some logistical reason, but they had to testify at a trial that was going to put some terrorist, you know, behind bars, and it's absolutely essential for the national security that they come and they testify. They could be paroled in for the duration temporarily for that particular trial period, and then they could go back home again. And
it's sort of like, you know, a catch-all waiver in, and it was meant to be used in very narrow circumstances.
Exactly. And Congress has come back and confirmed that, you know, because it was abused under previous administrations, not to the scale that Biden has done it. And so Congress went back and rewrote the law, I think it was 96, and inserted some language to say that parole has to be on a case-by-case basis. It has to be for significant public benefit of the United States or humanitarian reasons on a case-by-case basis. It cannot be used to bypass the asylum system and the refugee program. I mean, they really tried to make it clear. The one thing they didn't do, and I just wrote about this in my column last week, they didn't put a numerical limit on it. And unfortunately, if you allow Yeah, if you put a loophole in and you don't specifically say it can only be used 100 times, which was, you know, a couple hundred times was typical of previous administrations, then theoretically it could be used for, you know, a million people or 10 million. And that's pretty much what happened.
Yeah. And so the new designate who's going to be looking after the border looks like a pretty tough kind of no-nonsense guy. Do you know him? Or does his reputation, precede him? Do you think you have confidence he will get the job done and be able to get it under control? At least the border crossings in the US.
Yeah, you're talking about Tom Homan, he's been given the title Border Czar. I think that's kind of a gentle poke at Vice President Harris, who denied strenuously that she was the Border Czar. But it's not an official title, but he will be at the White House, the guy coordinating our national whole of government response to the disaster that we've had on the border and the mass population of essentially illegal immigrants that we have. Tom is he's a professional who's been doing this for about 40 years. He was a Border Patrol agent. He's from the northern border, from New York State, I believe, but he's worked on the southern border, all across the southern border. So he knows the literal border, the physical border. He knows the Border Patrol. He knows how the job is done. And he was a visiting fellow at Heritage, so I've had the opportunity to work with him. He's done lots of presentations for us. And he is absolutely passionate about national security, about saving lives, because a lot of people die trying to get illegally into the United States and across Latin America and the Darien Gap and the Rio Grande. Mm-hmm. There's trafficking of women and children on an industrial scale. There's fentanyl coming in at the rate of enough to kill about 60,000, 70,000 Americans a year. Mm-hmm. And Tom passionately believes that we need to get this under control. He has been saying this as long as I've known him, and he's always said that he would do anything that he was asked to do. And I think he's the guy who can, I don't want to say anybody could completely solve this problem in 4 years, but if anybody can make significant progress, it's going to be Tom.
Yeah, right. Again, things like the importation of fentanyl by the southern border is not something yet, at least, Australia experiences in any real way. We have ICE and stuff, but it's not quite the same scale as what I understand is going on in the US. Why do you think that it has been allowed to fester, not only to such a scale in the US, not just under the Biden administration, but, you know, well before? Trump ran in 2015, and that was one of his key issues, which was sort of ignored by a lot of the other political class. So it was clearly an issue then, a big enough issue to sort of propel him to the White House. What is it in the kind of American psyche that hasn't enabled the crackdown on illegal immigration that we were able to do in Australia, you know, way back in 2001 and 2002?
That's a good question. Why isn't it possible for us to at least agree that immigration should be legal? I mean, I've said this ever since I started working in this field, you know, almost 25 years ago now, that it's Congress's responsibility, prerogative under the Constitution, to decide who gets to come and how long they get to stay and what the terms are. And it's the executive's job to enforce the law that Congress passes. And we can argue about what that number should be. Should it be 500,000, 1 million, 10 million? Should we have open borders? I mean, there are people who advocate at the, you know, Libertarian Cato Institute and on the, you know, the far socialist left for open borders, for a global right to migrate, for, you know, essentially, you know, one world. And there are those of us who argue that nation states are important and that we need to preserve that by limiting the number of people who come in and make sure that they assimilate and adopt our values and so on. But we don't seem to be able to agree on those terms. So we're stuck with the numbers and the limits that we have from, like I said, the last time it was meaningfully addressed was 1996. And so there's a paralysis in Congress. And nationally, I guess it's a matter of distance. I think we're such a big country that people didn't feel the consequences of illegal immigration in the way that they have in the past 4 years. The number has been so extreme in the past 4 years that you've seen cities like Denver, New York, Chicago, Boston, San Diego overrun. I mean, we're talking about tens of thousands of people being put up in hotels, parks. In New York City alone, there's like 200 ad hoc centers set up to house them. They took over a national park where people used to go and, you know, spend their weekends. So in a way that it never happened before, we've always had, as I said, a trickle of illegal immigration and people who come here on visas and overstay. But I don't think it really penetrated the national consciousness in the way that it has recently. And so I guess that would be my answer, is that it's an issue that has been brought to the forefront by its sheer scale. And in the past, it was important to some people, but not enough to really swing elections.
Yeah, it's always striking to me the contrast between ostensibly, you know, conservative people like George W. Bush and Jeb Bush and those types who talked about illegal immigration in a way that I would struggle to imagine some of our leaders here talking about legal immigration. Like, there's no way John Howard would talk about legal immigration being an act of love, or saying, you know, family values don't stop at the East Timor Sea. I think my explanation, at least from abroad, is that it's partly to do with the American, you know, at least the traditional sense that America is this nation of ideals rather than, and probably extended too far in that direction. You know, Ronald Reagan was always about like opening, different era, but was very much open borders and let them come. And that clearly, you know, eventually had to bump into some type of reality, because not everyone can come and not everyone is American just because they happen to like, I don't know, freedom of speech and stuff. Illegal immigration is worse, but legal mass immigration in Australia is very, very high. And it's increasingly high in the United States too. President-elect Trump has been famous for wanting to build the wall and stop legal immigration. But at least as far as I've been able to tell, has been much vaguer when it comes to things like legal immigration. What do you expect his policy to be in that regard?
I would have a hard time guessing. He likes to sort of float trial balloons and ideas. So I don't tend to take him literally if he says something, you know, in an interview or a 3-hour podcast. I don't, you know, take that to the bank as some policy that's going to be top of his list. I would say that controlling illegal immigration is the number one priority. He's made that really clear throughout the campaign and the first time he was president. And our legal immigration numbers are about 850,000 a year. It's under a million, which in the context of a country of whatever we are now, 330 million, you know, is doable. It's not an overwhelming number. We need people to come and innovate and work, and that's been the lifeblood of this country. But there is a limit to what you can absorb to the schools and the hospitals and the infrastructure. And the last 4 years, we've definitely overwhelmed that limit. So I would think that legal immigration reform is possible, but it's not going to happen. We're not going to have a serious conversation about that until we've got the illegal immigration under control. And then there's a little bit of willingness to negotiate on both sides.
Do you think that's a potential problem? Because in Australia, immigration is a major issue, but it's now legal mass immigration, which is the problem, not illegal immigration. At least illegal immigration crossing borders. People can come home, get here, and then work the system to sort of ultimately end up here. And our foreign-born population is now much higher than, well, certainly anywhere, any of the big cities in the US, although the percentage is rising over there. So do you think why can't you do both? Why can't you crack down on legal immigration as well as illegal immigration at the same time? Because the strain on resources and everything else, and the strain on social cohesion, we have found in Australia with legal immigration, even with high-skilled legal immigration, still does arise. It's very hard to sort of properly model what the impact will be on things like, traffic jams and housing prices and inflation and all sorts of other things. So I just get the sense, again, from abroad, but correct me if I'm wrong, that legal immigration probably hasn't had the sort of focus in the US to date that, from afar, you know, in Australians at least, it feel like it should be. So I'm curious as how.
I think the theme is very similar in a lot of Western countries. If you talk to the guys at the Cato Institute, you talk to libertarians, some conservative Republicans, but who are more on the, you know, the business chamber of commerce side, they act as if, you know, human beings are just, they're just economic engines. Yeah. They're just, you know, robots basically who make things. And so if you have a labor unit that can produce 5 cars a day or 100 widgets, who cares what it looks like, where it comes from? Does it matter if this labor unit can sing the national anthem or can tell you the history of the country or would fight for it if a war happened or loves it or cares about its values or values freedom of speech or women's rights or, you know, any of the things that make the United States unique and make Australia unique and make Great Britain and Germany and so on unique? To this far left, and I'll say libertarian right, it doesn't matter. You can replace 10 American workers with 10 workers from any other country and you get the same result. I think to those of us that are nationalists, that believe in nation states, we see immigration in that context, that of course you can bring people in, you can teach them your values and absorb them. Every Western country has done this to some degree. But there is a price to be had. If you have immigration from particular parts of the world that happens too fast in certain areas, you end up with subcultures that may not adhere to the national culture. Now, we've seen this after October 7th in capitals all over the Western world, where you have really large demonstrations anti-Israel and supporting this terrorist group in the Middle East that don't accord with, I would say, the sentiment of the country as a whole, its political stance and the views of its people. So I think the policy debate, at least from a conservative perspective, has to take that into account. We either can accept this sort of globalist idea that really people can live wherever they want and there should be an international right to migrate, and then let's just let the economy sort it out, supply and demand. Or we can accept that there are other considerations at play and that nation states have the right to determine who comes in and they get to ask something of the people who come in. It's a two-way street. And that those countries, just like you get to say who comes into your house and set the rules, nation states get the right to set the rules on who comes in and how. And that debate is definitely going to get harder now that the indigenous populations of Western Europe, for example, are shrinking, and Japan and other developed countries, you've got birth rates that are extremely low. And the populations of the absolute poorest failed states are expanding at an incredible rate. So there's going to have to be that debate, and that factor is going to have to be taken into consideration.
Yeah, it's similar debates across the Western world. They all have their little nuances and particular vocabularies and legislations and parties that are up that are down. But, you know, you get left-wing parties, ostensibly left-wing parties in Europe, in Sweden now, cracking down pretty hard on immigration. And you have Keir Starmer, the left-wing Labour leader, now saying open borders wasn't just an error, but it was bad by design, or words to that effect. And Justin Trudeau and the rest of it. I have to ask a broader question, because you're at Heritage, and maybe this is a misapprehension from afar, but I kind of get the impression, listening to someone like a Tucker Carlson, who generally has quite disparaging things to say about think tank world generally, that he has tended to draw a distinction when it comes to the Heritage Foundation and say that they are on the side, generally on the good side of things, and not like the others. Where have you parted ways with some of the other think tanks in Washington? What are you doing differently, or is my impression sort of unfounded?
Well, I'm relatively new to this world, to Washington. I spent most of my career overseas. I only had 3 years in Washington working at the State Department. So you know, I've observed this internecine conflict from afar, yeah. And I always take the attitude that conservatives need to stick together if we want to win elections and we want to carry the policy day. And we can have our internal arguments and disputes, but turning the guns on each other is suicide when we're confronted by a united political enemy that is able to kind of whip the troops in order and win elections on a local and national scale. Are there differences? Yeah, I mean, Heritage is, I think, the biggest think tank and certainly the biggest conservative one. You have the Cato Institute, which is libertarian, so they support essentially unlimited immigration, open borders, and some other theories that probably wouldn't meet with approval on our floor where the economists sit. But we do share some values. For instance, there's a guy at Cato that I'm always on panels with, and we pretty much disagree. But we do agree that you should not have a welfare state and open borders, because that's the toxic combination that's really destroying the economy in the U.S. Because even if they can argue that in the long term, immigration is good for the economy, and you can argue the opposite, but let's just say that that's possible. Well, we know that in the short term, uneducated and illegal immigrants with no skills cost a lot more than they give to the economy. So there's an area of agreement on immigration, even between, you know, two sort of opposites. Mm. And then there's disputes about how we should handle Ukraine, the Middle East, and policy disputes that I think, you know, when you're never going to get 100% of people to agree on. But by and large, especially after 4 years in the wilderness, I would say conservatives are pretty united on what we need to get done. One area of agreement I would like to see a little bit more at the forefront, and maybe this will happen at some point, is to get the fiscal situation in order. Because like France and Great Britain and so many other countries, we are facing a budget deficit that's almost locked in now, and a debt as a consequence that is being serviced at a rate that just everybody knows is unsustainable, but no one seems to have a plan yet to fix it. So I'm hoping the leadership on that will come from the conservative side over the next 5 years at least.
Well, there are plans, at least you read in the papers, about, you know, Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy and their Doge. It's hard to get a sense from afar how serious one should take that. It sounds, at least to my way of thinking, kind of inspired. And, you know, Elon tends to have these moonshot proposals and people discount them, but then he often goes ahead and actually, you know, makes good on them. How realistic, how serious should people, we take those proposals from afar?
I take the DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency proposal, very seriously, because I worked in the government for 23 years, and I there are a lot of great people working in the U.S. government and at state and local governments, but there is absolutely no doubt that we have a bloat and a sort of creep of administration that is, again, unsustainable and really it's counter to the national interest, which is growing the economy and making the standard of living rise. I mean, just take one example. We've got about 2.2 million civil servants at the federal level in the U.S., and that number has just steadily grown through the Great Depression and then the Great Society, all of these social programs that came in. If you look at schools, the percentage of administrators has grown at a staggering rate, and the percentage of faculty of teachers and students has stayed about the same, or it's grown at a, you know, a rate with the population. So you have public school systems where they've got, you know, twice as many administrators as they have teachers. So at the federal level, I'm certain that there's substantial savings to be had. I'm certain that we could do the job with fewer people. That doesn't mean everybody has to be sacked. You know, there's always attrition in government as people retire. And with artificial intelligence and other tools that are coming online, there's a lot of boring work that could be done more efficiently by, you know, AI and other artificial intelligence systems or other computerized, whatever digital means. We have far too many civil servants, I think, located in the Washington, D.C. area, which is one of the most expensive parts of the country. I don't understand why, and I think they're looking at relocating parts of some federal agencies to places in the country where they would be more naturally housed, like agriculture being maybe somewhere in the Midwest where they actually farm in on large scale, or energy being in Texas or places where they actually drill for oil and energy and so on. So you never want to underestimate Elon Musk. I mean, he's a fascinating character, but he goes down in American history like Andrew Carnegie and John D. Rockefeller and Thomas Edison as a really unique personality who, as you say, gets things done. I mean, when you watch that rocket ship come back to Earth and be recycled, and then the one that got caught, you know, perfectly on the stand as it came back, and you see that his private company has been able to do things that NASA, which was once the world leader in space exploration, hasn't been able to do. You look at the Boring Company, where he's drilling underneath cities to alleviate the traffic on the surface. Mm-hmm. Tesla becoming, out of nothing, I think the world's biggest and certainly leading electric car maker, and so on. You know, you do not want to underestimate that guy. I think they're coming into it with serious intent. They're up against a lot, of course, because the state has been there a long time.
As you know, having worked in the state, I've never worked in the public service, but the civil servants have protections. They will fight tooth and nail. I'm sure in the States there's a big public sector union that will, I don't know, shut the Washington DC down and strike and do sorts of, and squeal about all sorts of things if there's any hint of major retrenchments. And they, you know, there's a lot of a legal framework put in place so that it will be hard to move quick. It'll be hard to sack people in the same way that you sacked whatever you sacked, you know, 70% of the staff of Twitter, now X, right? So I'm just trying to get a sense of someone who actually worked in the public service for so long, whether you think it's realistic that this efficiency, no doubt there is bloat there, without a doubt, but whether it can actually be kind of cut into in a meaningful way, or is it easier to go to Mars than do that, you know?
It's probably easier to go to Mars, but no, I think it can be done. And I don't think it's about cutting people. They've not said that. We don't have unions that are public sector unions that are able to strike in the US, at least in theory. So that's not going to be a thing. There'll be resistance from people who just oppose Trump's agenda in general. And the moment you start talking about people's livelihoods, they get very nervous, understandably. But I don't think that's the gist of this. This is about, for example, I think only 6% of federal workers are working a full 40-hour week in the office. Well, you tell them, look, if your job is necessarily done in the office, you got to come back to the office. COVID was a temporary thing. It blew everything up. We all did things differently, but it's over now. Let's get back to the office. Or let's look and see, can you do your job equally efficiently somewhere else? In which case, we can save on the overhead for your office, your air conditioning and heat and light, and maybe your transportation, you know, pay you a little bit less because you're living in remote area and not in the big city. And everybody wins. But right now we're doing it the worst possible way, which is we've got the office on and the air conditioning, the heating, and everything's there, except there are people working from home 2-3 days a week. Now, some people are efficient working from home. My wife's much better than I am. But I think in general, the people that I know and from what I've observed, we're all a little bit less efficient working from home. And so that's one efficiency that they can do right off. And if people decide that they got so used to working from home that they'd rather keep doing that and do something else, well, that's great. That's, you know, nobody should stay in a job that they don't like, where they don't feel like they're adding value and it's not personally rewarding for them. So I think the efficiencies, it might start off incremental, and it doesn't have to be about laying people off. It's about putting people to work in a more efficient way, having them do things that need to be done. I certainly saw in the State Department, there were some people who worked really long hours doing things that absolutely needed to be done. And there were lots and lots of jobs that were very difficult to see what the value was being added. You know, writing reports that are redundant and that nobody reads. That's not efficient. That's not a good use of taxpayer dollars. So as long as they're willing to hire staff and really kind of look into the weeds, we should be able to encourage federal workers to come along for the ride, because theoretically, and I believe this is true of most of them, They are loyal, patriotic Americans who are, they know they're working for the taxpayer and they want to provide value for this salary. So, you know, we've got to go in there hoping that they can be won around to these efficiencies and these ideas because they're innovations that are in everybody's best interest.
Speaking of one of the types of programs which lead to inefficiencies, you have written a couple of papers on how diversity, equity, and inclusion programs are harmful to the State Department and ultimately undermine U.S. foreign policy. Can you explain that? How does that happen and how does that play out?
Well, fundamentally, if you're hiring for a job, you want to hire the person who is best suited to do that job. And, you know, as I've said more than once, I don't care if all my pilots are black, if all my brain surgeons are women, if all my plumbers are Jews, as long as they can fly the planes, fix the brains, unclog the drains. That's the bottom line. You can change the ethnicities, change the jobs. The point is you want to have people who are your soldiers and your spies and your astronauts and your data scientists and your surgeons who are the best at that job. That's always been the American way. We are a land of opportunity. We have people of all races and colors and sexual preferences and other variables who have achieved at the highest level, whether it be in government or in business or whatever. And that fundamental, you know, meritocracy, that principle has in the last 5 years at least, but I would say it goes back a little bit further than that, been undermined by this ideology of oppressor and oppressed. It's a neo-Marxist concept that I'm sure you're familiar with, that's found its way into academia in things like critical race theory and anything ending in theory, where we sort of reframe everything. And what came out of that, in at least in the federal government, and I would say our large corporations, was diversity, equity, inclusion. It's been sometimes, you know, it's they flip the letters around. And the key word there is equity, because no one's against diversity. No one's against inclusion. With small D and a small I, the concepts are fine. Equity, the way it's now translated into hiring at the federal level, is we want to have outcomes that look like this. So this percentage of men and women, this percentage of black and white and Asian and Hispanic and so on. And so they have to engineer all of the intake, the exams. If the exam produces too many of one person and not another, then they have to either throw the exam out or they have to come up with some other mechanism to bypass the exam. So that's what they did in medical schools, in law schools, in universities. And now they've done it, just to take the Foreign Service, for example. Our system used to be take an exam. I think you probably have a civil service exam in Australia. I know they did have one in England. It's very hard. Only a tiny percentage of people pass. And then they have like a fast stream for the ones who get the really, really good grades, and then a slightly slower stream. Our system was similar for the Foreign Service. There was a written exam. If you passed that, you went on to what they call the oral exam in person for half a day. And then if you passed that, you were invited to become a Foreign Service officer most of the time. And now they've, in the pursuit of equity, which, as Vice President Harris said, means we all end up in the same place, which sounds awfully like socialism and not like America. They have changed it so that the percentage of people who pass the oral exam is about 50%, and it used to be around 5%. And you don't have to pass the written test anymore. You have to get a certain score, and then they kind of put it through this, they call it a qualification evaluation panel, I think it is, QEP, which is like a black box where they're able to inject all of these factors that end up with the right percentage of races at the other end. So I don't think I certainly don't oppose diversity of hiring. I think it's great that we have a Foreign Service and an army and, you know, doctors and nurses and teachers who look like America, and that they should be coming from every part of our country and our you know, every race and every state and so on. But I firmly reject the idea of insured outcomes, because that almost by definition, it means that you're going to end up with a lower quality of applicant at the end. So this is how it undermines the efficiency of the State Department and universities, grants that come out of the federal government and every agency because of executive orders that came out of the Biden White House on the first day, essentially, and then were followed up pretty quickly afterwards.
Is it also because this is so embedded now in the ideology of the State Department that they roll it out into countries where I don't know, they're too early for it, or they have much more traditional kind of views and ways of life, and can actually undermine America's foreign goals and interests in that region because they end up ticking off the local population. I know that happens to some degree in Australia when they're dealing with South Pacific Islands and they push, you know, LGBT stuff, you know, quite hard in traditional Christian Tonga communities and the like. And it's just not a priority for those communities, those nations. And yet it is a priority. It seems like the number one priority for the US State Department, you know, flying the rainbow flag in Afghanistan or the trans flag, this, that, and the other. And I don't know. I mean, to me, standing back, it's like, well, how, you know, surely you can trim your sails a little bit depending on the location, but that doesn't seem to be really much of an element of or ability to compromise on those types of things. It's very ideological. Is that your experience, or is that just me reading it through the press, which tends to highlight some of the more outrageous?
That's absolutely my experience. And if you look at the pronouncements coming out of the State Department, I think what I see a thing yesterday celebrating, was it pansexual?
Yeah, I saw that too. Yeah, that was
How is that really something that we're going to try to promote overseas? As you say, I mean, I've spent time in Tonga. I spent 2 years in Fiji. They are societies that have evolved and developed over time. They've become Christian because of contact with English and the Anglosphere, but they develop in their own way. And in some ways, they're more conservative than we are. And there are certain things that we should be pushing. Like we should never oppress people because of their religion or their race or their sexual preference or whatever. Mm-hmm. But that does not mean that we should try to persuade Christian countries in Africa, like Uganda or Ghana, that a man can decide to be a woman, and that's just a fact. Or, you know, for instance, we're always talking about female genital mutilation and what a horrible thing it is, and it is horrible. But yet, we also tell them if you have a boy who's, you know, 12 and thinks he's a girl, that it's okay to, you know, castrate him. I mean, that is just nonsensical. We have not resolve these debates back in the United States. We are still hotly discussing these issues. You know, gender ideology, I don't believe, has won the day, and I hope sanity will prevail. But in the meantime, the last thing we should be doing is, you know, hoisting that flag in our embassies overseas and trying to make that one of our, you know, first negotiation points. We need to put that stuff in the back. That's for us to deal with on our own. And let's talk about the values that we've always had: freedom of speech, democratic elections, peaceful transfers of power, and so on.
Yeah, I mean, we are dealing with that in Australia, as you might be aware. We have, well, numerous things going on. We have in Queensland, which is where I'm based, a practitioner, a child psychiatrist, who's been stood down for objecting to the what's called gender-affirming care. I think she's the first person globally that's actually been formally sort of stood down because of that. We've got the Giggle v. Tickle case, which is this app where it's gone all the way to the High Court, which is the equivalent of the Supreme Court here in Australia, to decide whether a man identifying as a woman is allowed to be participated in what is meant to be a female only app. And it turns on the question of whether he's a man or, you know, these questions which you think are very simple, but the law does not make it so. So anyway, that's just something that our Department of Foreign Affairs also pushes quite hard, and it is hard to reconcile that with what the national goals and interests of Australia really should be. Speaking of relationships that America has with other countries, the President-elect Trump issued a statement yesterday on social media referring to Governor Trudeau of Canada, of the state of Canada. I mean, what exactly? At one level, it's kind of funny and in keeping with his style. At the other, I can imagine the people in the State Department and others going, how do we deal with this going forward? What, at its heart, what is exactly the United States seeking in its trade relationship with Canada?
Well, I'm not an expert on trade, but you know, Canada is a massive trade partner. We share a border 5,000 miles with them, a common language, at least you know the English speaking part, and so much history that they're an ally of ours, and we've had great relations for a couple hundred years. So I think that relationship is going to remain, and no matter which party's in control of either country, I don't think the trade and exchange between the countries is going to stop. Justin Trudeau's Canada for 10 years has really taken a pretty far left turn. Mm. I mean, their immigration policy is, I would say, the legal part is as bad as our illegal part. They have brought in really colossal numbers of people, particularly students and temporary workers, who are finding ways to stay there even when their so-called temporary visa runs out. And that's led to problems with housing, with hospitals and healthcare and welfare. And then at the same time, you know, his COVID policy was really draconian, you know, cutting down on people's right to protest, debanking them, a very Orwellian approach which has kind of shocked Americans. We always think of Canada as being, you know, kind of a mellower version of the US, but in this sense, they've gone way more to the extreme than we have. And when it comes to the gender ideology and other sort of parts of what we could call wokery, the Canadians leave us in the dust. Now, I suspect that the next election is going to see Trudeau's party and many of his policies out. There's a guy called Pierre Poilievre, who I've seen speak a few times, and he's quite amusing and quite wry. But he would definitely take the country in a different direction that I would suspect would be more in keeping with President Trump's agenda. Obviously, just like with Mexico, we have to deal with whoever's there. But I would think that the next Canadian government might be a little more ideologically aligned with the next American government. We've definitely got to get that northern border under control, because some of the people who are running out of their visas in Canada are trying to make it into the United States. It has been much easier to get into Canada than it is to get into the United States by air. And so you've had people flying in from India and China and even Mexico who fly into Canada and then make their way over the land border, which I've been up to and is really huge and, let's just say, very sparsely defended. And then on trade, there's been a lot of talk of tariffs. And I don't know what will happen with that ultimately, but it sounds as if that will be a negotiating tool or factor, at least in the 2026 renegotiations of what used to be called the North American Free Trade Agreement, and then was the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Trade Agreement. But it's like our little free trade zone between the three North American countries. And so I think that'll definitely be a factor to be considered then.
Yeah, I'm just waiting for Australia to catch the eye of Elon Musk or Donald Trump and us to receive a similar type of, I guess you can joke around with friends and allies in a way that you probably can't joke around with other people, and they hopefully took it the right way, the Canadians, but it will be a shot up the backside to some of our government officials here, I think, when they see their name in lights in a tweet from the president-elect. On immigration, moving back to that, which is your area, it was, as I recall, one of the only sort of sticking points between Australia and the US under the first Trump administration, where Malcolm Turnbull, our then prime minister, was trying to get the US to accept a certain number of what sounded like not great asylum seekers into the US. Are there likely to be other types of deals like that which are put on the table, or is that those types of things going to arise, do you think, between Australia and the United States going forward?
I'm trying to remember the details of that. It was a while back, and I think a pretty small number, and I don't remember specifically what the ask was. But our problem is that we have an official U.S. refugee admissions program, which has a numerical limit that the president can set. I think under Biden, it was like 125,000, where the The refugees are identified overseas. They're screened for security, for family relationships, to make sure they actually are refugees. That's the program that we're supposed to have. And how we bring people into that is one set of negotiations. And then we have a completely illegal, informal system where people are released at the border by this administration, knowing that they are most likely going to claim asylum or just disappear. So we've really got to get that unofficial a system, and also parole. They're paroled in, and the intention of the administration is that then they're going to claim asylum after they've been paroled in, which, as I was saying before, is specifically what the law said they shouldn't be doing. As to whether it'll come down to whether there'll be a specific issue with Australia, do you remember what the population was in particular?
Oh, it was a small number, but I think they were rejected in Australia because of the criminal conviction. So they weren't the best, as Trump would say. And so he probably had right to object to why the US was accepting these people. And it might have been in exchange for something else. I will have to get across the details myself. It was just a while back. And it wasn't the only, in what's generally a very good relationship, was one of those sort of things that was talked about in the press. And who knows, might come up in future. But what do you think, by the end of Trump's 4 years in office, provided he's not, God knows what, something happens, what do you hope and expect America's immigration program to look like? Will there be a wall built? Will they deport large numbers of people? Or is that just sort of talk, which will ultimately crash against the reality of the situation?
Yes and yes. I very much hope. I've been down to the border from San Diego, literally in the Pacific, up to my knees, all the way to the other side of, near Galveston. And I've been up to the northern border. Now, the southern border has a wall in places. It has a barrier in others. I mean, the wall looks different depending on where you are. But it is an impediment to people coming over illegally. The people say, well, I'll just get a bigger ladder. Women and children are not going to climb a 40-foot ladder to jump over the other side. It does reduce the number of people who come through, and it forces them to go to other places where they can be properly received by U.S. authorities. So I would sincerely hope that the construction on the wall, which Biden shamefully abandoned, having the money was voted, the materials were there, and you can go and you can see them just sitting there rusting. And in many cases, they've been sold off at pennies on the dollar. I think that was absolutely disgraceful. And I've been to places where there's one in Arizona where there's a gap where they were supposed to put a gate in the wall, I guess, to let cars through or something in emergencies. And they never finished the gate. So it's just like a giant door, with people just kind of walking in at all hours. So I would like to see that done. I think that's in our national interests. I mean, if you want to see the best wall ever, go to the border, look at it from aerial photographs of Egypt and Gaza. it's not like walls are an American thing. It is any country that has a neighbor that they want to be sure that they can admit only under certain conditions is advised to build a wall, back to the time of the ancient Romans and the Chinese. Yeah. And as to deportations, we were talking about Tom Homan and his focus on this. Yes, I think there will be a major increase in the efficiency of that regime. And look, even if we were just talking about the criminal, we're talking about the criminal aliens that were in Australia that maybe you were trying to get rid of. We have in the United States 430,000, give or take, convicted criminal aliens, people who have no right to be in this country, who are also convicted robbers, rapists, whatever. Now, they should be back in their home countries. The risk of recidivism should be on their home countries and not on us and in our streets. We have 1.3 million people who have final removal orders. That means they've been given their entire due process. Maybe they claimed asylum and they were told, look, I'm sorry, you don't qualify. And they're still here because we haven't been able to execute those orders. So the pool of people, even if you just start there and then work your way down the more recent arrivals, is big enough that they could ramp it back up to levels that we saw in the Obama administration of 400,000 a year, 500,000 a year of deportations. Some people would probably leave themselves if they felt like they were eventually going to be removed. So I think those are two very realistic goals that could be achieved in this Trump administration, that we would see construction resumed on the wall and hopefully it finished. And we would see law enforcement, meaning removal orders actually need to be carried out and people do need to be deported if that's what has been ordered.
And so just to get my head around the numbers, how many in your view, because there's always different figures bandied around, how many do you think illegal immigrants have entered the United States in the last 4 years, let's say, even though, or further back? How many ideally should be deported?
Well, those are two different questions. I would say... Maybe 10 million people have entered illegal. If you're counting parole, release at the border, and snuck in without anybody noticing, that could be around 10 million.
Right.
It could be a little lower, it could be a little higher. If you're talking about the total population of people who are living here illegally, they don't have a visa, they don't have any actual right to be here, possibly they're in process of claiming asylum or whatever. The estimates that I've seen vary from 15 million to 25 million, probably more realistically on the higher side, like around 20, 25 million. It's a lot of people. Yeah. But there are many categories.
Almost the population of Australia. Right?
Yeah. So. Yeah, it is. And it has massively increased in the past 4 years. So we've made the problem a lot worse, but that doesn't mean, and in some sense, I think that was political. That was a decision that was made deliberately because they figure if we make it so bad, then they won't be able to fix it. They'll just have to grant an amnesty and go home. And I think they underestimated the will of President Trump and the people who elected him to actually get things done and try to solve the problem. But it is true. It is a large number of people with lots of different complicated categories going from the instantly removable because they have deportation orders and criminal convictions down to, you know, things like temporary protected status or the deferred action on childhood arrivals and, you know, all these other categories, people who are in the middle of asylum claims and so on, that will be more complicated to deal with, but can be done.
Yeah. I just feel like we're a little bit in the calm before the storm. Everyone sort of knows in theory it's coming, but then once you actually... the language is wrong, but encounter the enemy will start to implement the program in full. You get all the sad cases, which the media will highlight. Maybe public opinion softens a bit. And then there's inevitably delays with legal processes and the like. It's not simply a question of like gathering a bunch of troops in Washington, D.C. and sending them out and then gathering everyone and hauling them across the border. It's just... inevitably more complicated than that, right?
Yeah, no, it's more complicated, but it's also not just removals and deportations that have to happen. It all has to happen at the same time. We have to reinstitute the Remain in Mexico, the migrant protection protocols, where just like you have your Nauru, and you don't let people land in Australia by boat and become Australians. That's just a rule. People know that, so they don't come anymore by boat. And when you took the brakes off, 10 years ago, all of a sudden the boat started coming again. So I think Australians get that the policy protects them against mass arrivals by sea. Migrant protection protocols worked for the United States. It told people from India and China, for example, that if they spent $10,000 on a smuggler to fly them into Nicaragua or wherever or Mexico and walk up to the border, that they weren't necessarily going to get released into the country just by saying they have a credible fear of persecution back home on account of XYZ. They were going to have to wait in Mexico, just like if they were refugees in Kenya or from Somalia, they would have to wait in the Dabab camp until they'd been processed for admission to a country that wanted to have them. So you have that, you have the wall, you have removals ramped up, and you get rid of this expectation that people now have that they can get into the United States, they can work, they can send money home, and they can call for their families, and no one's going to come for them under any terms, even if they literally have no case at all for asylum, they're just economic refugees. So I think it's a culture shift, and you're entirely right. They will find the most sympathetic case that they can, and they will trot those out. But the power of the media, of the legacy media in this country, which leans heavily left, has really been reduced in the past few years. You're seeing the viewership for CNN and MSNBC, people who buy the Washington Post, these numbers are going down every year because people are tired of being lied to, of being spun about these important issues. And they're getting their news from other sources. So that weapon might be blunted compared to how it worked 8 years ago.
Yeah, things are possible that are simply, I never thought would be possible 4 years ago or even earlier than that. I really appreciated the discussion. It is sometimes hard to wrap your head around precisely what's going on and all the different terminology and names and programs. And you wrote an article on surrogacy in the United States and the interaction with that and immigration policy, which again is something a bit more too complicated to get into the weeds now, but it's not, we don't have the same type of problem in Australia that you guys have in that respect. If people want to find out more about the work you do, Simon, and keep up to date with developments there at Heritage, what's the best way for them to find that out?
Sure. Well, I'm on Twitter for my sins at WatchfulWaiter1, and I usually tweet out my articles when I write them. And then if you go to the Heritage website, which is www.heritage.org, I believe, you can look up individual authors. You can look up subjects that you're interested in. We do pretty much everything. I mean, from energy policy to family issues to immigration, border security, foreign relations. There's probably someone at Heritage who's covering just about anything. And if you want to know what we're writing and thinking, that's the place to start. And yeah, Google's always your friend.
That's right. And I invite everyone to check out Simon's stuff because there's a stack of articles you've written and we've only covered a small part of it today. Thanks again, Simon. I really appreciate you making time and look forward to catching up with you at some stage in the future.
Thanks for having me on.
Cheers, man. Bye.
Bye.